You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. Today I'm honored to have as my guest Miroslav Holub. He is the Czech immunologist and poet. His first book in English of his essays, called Shedding Life, has just been published by Milkweed Editions. It follows a recent collection of his poetry called
Intensive Care,
which has been published by the Field Translation Series of the Oberlin University Press. Now, I've been reading Holub since an essay appeared by Seamus Heaney about his book Sagittal Section, and what fascinated me was that Heaney isolated a diagnostic-like and scalpel-wielding poet, in a sense an anti-humanist. And many of these essays define themselves against the conventions of humanism as a way of thinking that in a sense refutes reason and embraces a shallow notion of the poetic. And I wanted to begin by asking you where the rigor of the tone of voice of the poetry comes from.
Well, for me, because of my profession, I am a scientific worker, and by mentality, I am a scientific worker. So all my energy comes from actually my mental energy, and of course my mental, I would say, training and education comes from science. And if it is a vigor, I don't know, but my approach is something which Alex Comfort labeled as a heart-centered approach. And as you said, actually, it was very interesting what you said about humanism and anti-humanism. In some instances, it may sound as not exactly in the humanistic approach, but basically, in the long run, it is. Only we are not used to this approach.
Yes, it seems to me that what it is not so much anti-humanist as against the sentimentality of humanism, the impulsive, intuitive, unthinking aspect of humanism. Now, you speak about intuition in the course of the essays several times in order to contradict those who would think that science is a species of intuitive fumbling. But is poetry such a fumble?
I doubt it. Actually, can we say poetry is a generic name? But within this notion, there are many poetries. At least my kind of poetry is definitely non-intuitive. You can believe in dreams, you can believe in intuition. I simply don't believe in dreams, because of what we remember as a dream is already sort of an autopsy, it's a post-mortem of a dream. And what I think of intuition, it's by intuition we name something which comes again, which surfaces again in our mind, because it was forgotten. Yeah, it's just the recollection of something which has been already there.
It seems to me that what you substitute for sentimentality is tenderness. That tenderness, you give a list of things that are in your unconscious mind. You say the unconscious mind, for you, is not filled with archetypes, but filled with concrete moments of the past. A child who has cut her face with a knife and says that it's easy. You put the knife to the face and you just cut. But this is not to be harsh. This itemization of remembered moments seems to be full of a tenderness for the smallness of the human condition. It seems almost as if, as a studier of things on the level of cells, you bring to the consciousness of the human its insignificance, but a tenderness for that insignificance.
That's for me very interesting that you call it tenderness. You may be quite right. Maybe since my childhood I was slightly something which had some tender traits. One of the greatest human capacities is kindness. And I know I admire kindness. I admire kind people and kind acts, but I am not kind enough. So maybe I am just tender. And actually, it reminds me, once a Romanian poet made a world anthology of tenderness. And from the former Czechoslovakia, there have been two writers, Franz Kafka and myself. And I was very proud, and it was the first time I learned I have something tender in myself.
I would be very happy to see an anthology of tenderness, because it does seem to me to be an odd category of emotion. It's underneath certain bigger, blurrier things. The capacity to be tender seems to carry with it. It's almost the consolation prize for life, that we can invent tenderness, but our observation, or at least in the case of your own poetry, is merciless.
Yes, definitely it is.
We have two poems that I thought we could begin by hearing. These are very central Holub poems. The first is a brief reflection on the theory of relativity.
A brief reflection on the theory of relativity. Albert Einstein, in conversation, knowledge is discovering what to say. In conversation with Paul Valéry was asked, "Mr. Einstein, what do you do with your thoughts? Write them down immediately they come to you, or wait till evening or morning?" Albert Einstein responded, "Monsieur Valéry, in our craft, thoughts are so rare that when you get one, you certainly won't forget it, not a year after."
Miroslav Holub, a brief reflection on the theory of relativity. And the second poem, immediately, Space-Time.
Space-Time is basically a dialogue with a small child. Space-Time. "When I grow up and you get small, then, in Kaluza's theory, the fifth dimension is represented as a circle associated with every point in space-time. Then, when I die, I will be never alive again. Never. Never, never. Never, never. Yes, but never, never, never. No, not never, never, never. Just never, never." So we made a small family contribution to the quantum problem of 11-dimensional supergravity.
Space-Time by my guest Miroslav Holub. Now, in the course of these essays, you comment that it is very rare for a poet to make a contribution to the understanding of science, and you cite Edgar Allan Poe in Eureka, who seems to be a very peculiar contributor, given the fact that so much of what Edgar Allan Poe emits is blurry and peculiar and defined by poetic logics, a strict poetic logic, as he writes about in his theory of composition. But I wanted to ask you, are poets usually antithetical to science?
I believe usually poets believe they are antithetical to science. In essence, they, in my opinion, in my view, they are not. It's just something which Francis Bacon would call idola fori. It's the forum of the poets which says we are something quite different. There is a gap between us and the bloody scientists who are cynical, cool, unemotional, immoral, and so on. But basically, there is nothing more emotional than a work in a laboratory, and there is nothing cool about science, and I think there is and absolutely nothing immoral about science. If you just take science as an activity which must be done exactly and which must be repeated day after day and week after week. It takes lots of morale to be a non-cheating, a real scientist. And I think very many artists, very many literary figures can learn a lot from science, at least to be exact.
The tone on your part is for us to know that nature is not in fact wise and that there is not progress, that these are ways of speaking that make science illegible. Can you explain?
Well, that's a very difficult question about wisdom. I really say science cannot be wise because of wisdom is something which can be attached only to human psychology, to human existence, to human essence, and which changes with time. And science, compared with this human wisdom, is sort of blind. Nature is even unhuman. Because take my field, immunology, the defense against, let's say, foreign intruders. All of us, all individual men, have a different immune system which is prepared to cope with some pathogens, but not with all pathogens. Because the variability of pathogens is so broad, so immense, that due to mutation in our immune cells, we have to preview some not yet existing pathogens to be prepared. So that, if you want, the wisdom of nature is to preserve the species at the expense of killing some in a major epidemics, of killing some individuals. Always in any species, some individuals, thanks to their individual immune capacity, will survive and some should die. In our wisdom, in a human wisdom, or in a humanitarian approach, all animals and all people are created equal and all should survive, which of course is the essence of modern medicine, that we try that to save everybody, but that's already the human wisdom, not the wisdom of nature.
In the book of essays, Shedding Light, published by Milkweed Editions, subtitled Disease, Politics, and Other Human Conditions, you say at two different places, once the poetry offers an alternative for you, a way of coping with pains that you know cannot in fact be assuaged, but the poem may offer a model for temporary imaginary divergence, yes? And at another time you say, in answer to the famous put-down that a poet knows and a scientist thinks, you say that you don't give a wooden nickel for the truths of poetry. Now, what leads you, then, to embrace the falsity of poetry?
Well, the first half of your question referred to something which is basically, in my life, very simple. You know, in the laboratory, we follow the Murphy's Law. Murphy's Law says whatever can go wrong, it will. Mr. Postscript Murphy was an optimist. And so after a day of failure, when you sit down in the evening and would say, well, my God, what did I have? I done it. It's a lost day and I messed it up and so on. And finally, you in this mood, you can find a sort of a trigger for a poem. You do at least something. So the poem may be, in this sense, a consolation for a scientific mishap within one day. Basically, poetry in general is not a consolation for science in general. It's just in personal life. And so I would take it. Now, what was the second half of your question?
The wooden nickel for the truths of poetry.
No. Well, that's, again, we should have been philosophers to say, to really define what is truth. For in science, it's just the approximation of the scientific statement of the equation of the symbol to the observed reality and so the reproducibility of this given or defined result. That's the truth. For a poet, truth is something very deep, very human, above and below, in the darkness. And I doubt it. It's the same kind of truth. We are speaking about different kind of truth, and therefore the postmodernist would blame science. What they just pretend to have truth, but basically the general truth doesn't exist. But in a given, I would say, human approach, in a given human situation, there is a truth. Yeah, if you get some peritonitis, so the truth is you must be given an antibiotic called amikacin, and that's the truth. Otherwise, there is no cure.
In the long poem Interferon, you speak about the possibility of cure and what cure means and what stopping means, in a sense. And I wondered, is that poem written as consolation?
The poem is written as consolation. It's in my conditions, it's a very, very long poem. It goes over pages. And basically, it's part of my biography, the poem. And of course, when you write your biographies, you are looking for consolation for what you have done or what you haven't done. So in this sense, it is a consolation, and which can be derived from theatrical representation, from the play, from the game. Yeah, that is some consolation for me. And actually, when you are on a stage, you forget the dark things which are backstage or before the theater building and so on. That's the interference of theater with the dark side of human life. For the moment the performance goes on, you are elsewhere. You are slightly different when you are otherwise, and you have your temporary consolation.
Do you feel, I'm thinking in particular of the title of a book of stories by Babel. The title was You Must Know Everything. And it would seem to me that your suggestion to a writer would be you must know something, that writing must not be solely from the imagination, but be, in a sense, a report of the physical world, untouched and unblemished by the impositions the imagination would make on it.
I am alarmed by a statement by some young, promising Czech writers who stated in a couple of instances that they don't want to know anything, that the truth goes without information, that the truth goes without knowledge. Again, what kind of truth is it? It may be the truth about their own inner life, but even the inner life, what is inner life? That's the external life turned inside. It's just a reflection of the outer world. And so I hate this statement that we must have the nerve, that we must have the gut, not to understand anything. Yeah, it's for me, it's non-human, because a normal human being, and every man on the street must know something and must have as many information as possible. And I wish poets, or even young poets, would have as much information about the world of technology, of science, of politics, of economy, as every plain citizen. And basically because they are immersed in their deep inner self and they live in some kind of personal mythology, some of them refuse it.
Now, the listener so far would tend to assume then that what they were going to read would not make them laugh out loud. And yet, frequently, I find myself laughing when I read your essays, particularly the essay on the Vietnamese pigs and the defeat in the laboratory of... There was a desire to find a pig that could be studied, that would be of the right size, and these pigs, for all their smallness, were smellier, more difficult, intractable, repeating. There seems to be an absurdism that comes from Good Soldier Shrike, the sense that science is pitted against a bureaucracy and against a methodology that, if misused, will lead to triviality rather than to, pardon the word, discovery.
Yeah, that's true, and I make use of all these situations just to induce something which you could laugh about because of the humor or irony or even sarcasm. And generally said, something which induces human smile or human laughter is one of the few very clear positive aesthetic qualities of modern writing. What I hate, the life is complicated enough, and usually it's said enough. So why should we repeat it in our writing?
I wanted to read myself, because Miroslav Volov has expressed comfort reading the poems, but difficulty reading the essays. I wanted to read the opening paragraph of the title essay in this book. It's called Shedding Life. A wonderful title. Is that pun there, shedding light and leaving life, there in the original Czech as well?
No. In Czech it has another idiom. In Czech it says the shed blood. Yeah.
Ah.
Shedding life is an invention of the translator, and actually I would use this example to say that sometimes the translation even can improve the state of the piece of writing which is at hand. So I am very, very much inclined to have all kinds of translation, and I am very widely translated because maybe I am so simple or I am so... maybe partly my vocabulary, my way of expressing my syntax is derived from English.
This is the opening passage of Shedding Life. A muskrat, also called musquash, or technically Ondatra zibethica, Linn, 1776, the creature that didn't give a hoot about nomenclature, fell into our swimming pool, which was empty except for a puddle of winter water. It huddled in a corner, wild, frightened eyes, golden brown fur, hairless, muddied tail. Before I could find instruments suitable for catching and removing muskrats, a passing neighbor, unfamiliar with rodents per se, or even rodents living in Czechoslovakia since 1905, deciding he'd come across a giant rat as bloodthirsty as a tiger and as full of infections as a plague hospital, ran home, got his shotgun, and fired at the muskrat until all that was left was a shapeless, soggy ball of fur with webbed hind feet and bared teeth. There was blood all over the sides and bottom of the pool, all over the ball of fur, and the puddle of water was a little red sea. The hunting episode was over, and I was left to cope with the consequences. Humankind can generally be divided into hunters and people who cope with consequences. Now, as we go through this essay, Shedding Life, Holub goes into the pool to clean up the blood. And the essay would seem to want to induce a maximal sense of discomfort in the reader, almost as if this shock is intrinsic to the interest of literature, it seems to me, at least for you. And I wanted to ask about that, because in a certain way, it's a truly brutal essay, although the brutality is the neighbor's. Eventually, this is Holub, the immunologist, telling us about blood and the white blood cells and what is to be found there. So it's a collision, in a sense, of the brutal and the real.
Well, I don't think it was that brutal. Of course, the act of killing the poor muskrat was brutal. But there are so many acts every day, everywhere, in every pool in the world. In my mind or in my intention, the essay was ambivalent, because it says, of course, the rat, the rest of the rat, what remained of the fur and of the muscles and of the skeleton had to be buried, but the blood was still living. And actually, it teaches us that the process of death is as complicated as a process of birth of the multicellular organism, because in the blood puddles in the pool, they just represented the rest of the multicellular life on a unicellular level. And that's which is very important, even on the molecular level, because the single signals, intercellular signals, which would be present in the moment of death in the blood, were still present because the proteins down don't decompose so fast. So in a way, all the muskrat's inner life was still fooling around in the blood, which is so horrible because of the color. But on the other hand, the tiny surviving and still fighting cells are not so horrible. They are just, it is just sad, but not so brutal. And this I find essential, in a sense that we should speculate about how complicated bodies we are, how complicated multicellular life is, and how exceptional multicellular life is, because the bulk of life of the planet is still unicellular. We are just exception, which actually concerns also the so-called diversity. We are concerned about the diversity of some visible species, but we forget what really counts is the diversity of the unicellular organisms, which make the bulk of the living mass on the planet.
I've been speaking to Miroslav Holub. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. We've had additional production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse Podcast.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.